Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist of the environment, food, and health, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and everything that is going on in the greater context for our health, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our attitudes, the health of our media, the health of our society, and of course, the ecological stability of planet Earth. Each week on the show, we talk to different authors, experts, thought leaders, advocates, scientists, filmmakers, about all of the different facets of what's going on in our world that connects to health, life, and well-being for us as humans, as well as all species on Earth. I'm really delighted to have on the show today someone to whom I'm connected in ways we'll talk about a little bit on the show. He is a nationally known health leader and physician whom you will undoubtedly know in his own right. Our guest today is Joel Fuhrman, MD, the best-selling author of Eat to Live, The End of Dieting, and the recent The End of Heart Disease. This is his current book, and we'll be discussing the diet craze, what's behind it, what the effects of it are, and what people can really do to kind of stay out of the maelstrom and follow a sane pathway that's also science-based. Dr. Fuhrman, in addition to his books, is a board-certified family physician and nutritional researcher who specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. He's the research director of the Nutritional Research Foundation, as well as a best-selling author. And if you want to look his books up, the name Fuhrman is spelled F-U-H-R-M-A-N, and you know, we'll be kind of pointing you in various directions where if you want to read up about what we're talking about, you can follow through. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Joel Fuhrman. So happy to have you here with us today.
Oh, thank you, Allison. Pleasure to be here and speak to you and your listeners.
Oh, great. You know, I have been someone who has reported on health for, I guess, more than two decades. Don't want to date myself, but that is the case. And it's very interesting because, and I rarely talk about my own health from a personal aspect or anything like that on the show because my health is fine, and we're kind of covering a lot of the things that really undermine everyone's health on the program. But one thing I noticed in reading your books is that I had, just through knowing a lot about health and being exposed to everything that's out there, rather than I think like most people who are civilians just health-seeking, I'd been exposed to a lot of what's going on in terms of health recommendations and advice and everything, and I kind of have spontaneously arrived at something very similar to what you're recommending in your books. So I kind of found that was sort of interesting, but it kind of makes sense too. One of the things, I'd like to begin with is, what is this fixation on diet? What, there is a plethora of diet books. There are different kinds of approaches to diet. Everyone is espousing a different one. What's your take on why we have, suddenly this conversation, this confusion, this mix-up with so many different kinds of sometimes conflicting advice with people and the desperation with which overweight Americans, because, as a population, we are overweight and it's been getting worse, are attempting to fix this with diet. How has this come about?
Well, I don't know if I could answer that question with 100% accuracy when we know that the diet, we know we have the American diet is disease-causing, is with the most highest heart attack rates, stroke rates, cancer rates in the world, and certainly in world history. Cancer is a relatively new phenomenon, didn't even occur hundreds of years ago. There are populations around the world, even today, like the Catawba study, where you don't have high blood pressure or heart disease in populations and people eating more natural diets. We know that heart disease is a totally reversible and preventable illness and 100% dietary caused. And now the accumulating evidence in the last 20 years has really spoke the same for cancer, that we don't have to have breast cancer, we don't have to have prostate cancer, we don't have to, you know, that we can win the war on these diseases, not through modern technology and not through throwing money at more pharmacological research, but really on just getting people to eat an excellent diet with dietary and nutritional excellence. But your question speaks to the fact that everybody in the world is trying to make a buck selling some fad or trick or gimmick to have people lose weight, when the 90% or more of the non-commercially affiliated nutritional scientists around the world are in perfect agreement. This is not that complicated. We have to eat a diet high in micronutrients that contain that these micronutrients and the antioxidants that are present in an assortment of plant foods are necessary for maximize human immune function and protection against cancer. And that means that processed foods like pasta and bread and salad oils, including all oils, do not contain a rich source of micronutrients and phytochemicals. And then, so that's half the American diet are these processed foods. And the other half, and another 33% of what Americans eat are animal products that do not contain phytochemicals or antioxidants. So the amount of natural plant produce Americans eat is incredibly small, leaving us at risk of tremendous disease. And the point I'm making right now is that this is not debatable anymore, that the accumulating evidence is overwhelming. And all nutritional scientists worldwide agree that we have to eat more unprocessed fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts and seeds, mushrooms and whole grains, and less processed foods. And there's a growing army of evidence, and I say the word evidence very carefully here, giving more credence to studies that have hard endpoints. And hard endpoints are things like death, heart attacks, and cancer, not just things like weight loss over a year, where a person could gain it back 2 years later, or cholesterol drops. I mean, you could eat Twinkies or cookies, a Twinkie diet, and you could lose weight because you get sick of eating Twinkies and you eat less calories. But then long-term, you're going to die of cancer, you're going to get demented from eating Twinkies. The point is, we have to look at long-term studies. We can go over some of these long-term studies, but the point I'm making is that these three basic facts are in agreement with most nutritional scientists today, that we have to eat more unrefined plant foods, especially green vegetables, beans, onions, and mushrooms, and berries and seeds. Number two, we have to eat less animal products. High animal product diets are associated with higher levels of hormones, especially IGF-1 that promotes aging and cancer. And number three, high glycemic carbohydrates like white bread and white flour and sugar and honey and maple syrup don't just predispose people to obesity and diabetes. They also cause dementia, destruction of brain cells, loss of intelligence, increased propensity for violence and drug addiction, and, of course, increased risk of cancer. So it's not just about diabetes and gaining weight. It's about cancer. It's about mental function. It's about dementia and being happy in life, too, because commercial baked goods also cause depression. So to summarize, the response to your question is that I think that people are getting a lot of mixed messages with people looking for, they want to hear something good about what they want to eat. And people mm-hmm. have a tremendous amount of bias and predetermined agendas they want to promote. And it's almost rare that we have a large number of people looking at the scientific data in a non-biased and with no predetermined agendas, whether it's a vegan agenda or promoting animal products or telling people what they want to hear or trying to sell more, sell them some products or whatever it may be. I think that that there's more consensus than people actually recognize.
Mm-hmm. I was at a recent health conference this winter where David Katz of Yale talked to the same exact point. He said, it's almost like the climate science thing. He said everyone agrees. The science is all in agreement, and the scientists who follow it are all in agreement. But for some, because of the commercial marketplace with all of its different ways of framing the information or altering it or in the ways that you're describing, that message doesn't get through loud and clear to people. And so people can become confused or say, well, there are so many diets, I don't know what to do. I mean, you have been basically consistently following and promoting the same understanding for about 25 years. But I guess, you know, in a sense, the commercial mix-in, you know, selling products and all that you describe, makes it easier for people to be confused and to stay in their old habits rather than really making a substantive change. I mean, and I write and report a lot about some of the policy initiatives, the ways that we make policy decisions at the governmental level that drives the food supply down the right road. We make fattening and nutrient poor foods cheap and available to people. And then, you know, when they have the ensuing health problems, as we have seen in the last week or so, you know, it's like, I don't want to pay for that, and we pull the plug. So on the one hand, we have people, you know, industries that are profiting from cheap foods, from pesticide-laden foods. And then at the other end, when we have the ensuing health problems, we want to lay the blame on the individual. You know, on the social policy level, it would be great to make healthy vegetables like you're describing the ones that we subsidize, the ones that we promote, the ones that are more available, the ones that we put into neighborhoods where healthy vegetables are not available or too costly for people. But, you know, because that would probably save us billions of dollars in health care. But instead, because of the way our society is organized, it comes down to individuals recognizing the right foods, doing that for themselves, and also, you know, having the wherewithal to do it, which is another factor. Because, you know, I'll tell people, I have friends at all different levels of life, and I'll tell people, you know, really, you have to eat more vegetables on a daily basis. I, you know, if I cook for friends, I'll always serve that. And yet people, you know, they find it expensive to do that. It's more, you know, you could, you know, fill yourself up with chips as opposed to spending, you know, $3-4 or more for broccoli, you know. And sadly, that's what ends up happening. But even among people who have the financial wherewithal, I think these mixed messages just cause a lot of confusion. I mean, if you would just tell our listeners, you know, what the, like when you say nutrient-dense plant-based foods, we're talking about fruits and vegetables, right? Fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, mushrooms, beans. I noticed that, you know, let's describe, you know, the kinds of things that should be on our plates, if you would, for us, you know, every day.
Right. And one of my contributions to this world of scientific literature with regard to nutritional excellence is that I've shown in my research and findings that as people increase the amount of vegetables and high-nutrient plant foods, mm-hmm. their food addictions and cravings and emotional overeating decreases, and mm-hmm. that what I'm saying right now is that the more processed foods people eat and the foods that I call fast foods that get digested and absorbed very quickly, foods that mm-hmm. rush into the bloodstream rapidly, signal mm-hmm. of dopamine in, stimulation in the brain, and food is powerfully addicting. We even call sugar the gateway drug, because it's because it gets people started on, you know, alcoholism and drug use in later life. And many drug addicts get into drugs from their usual high they get from their high sugar diet when they're younger. The point I'm making right now, though, is that you're talking about the difficulty people have with change. And I'm adding to that and saying that when you're eating unhealthily and you're eating fast foods and processed foods, it decreases your intelligence. It makes you crave and want to and not feel wellness. You eat those foods and keep them coming in. And you need more and more stimulation of those foods in higher amounts, driving the obesity and illness epidemic. And then because of that, there's almost an illogical and delusional self-talk that occurs in the primitive brain that people who are addicts use to protect their addictions, make them make it more difficult for these people to change and eat healthy, because they're looking for reasons to maintain their addictions, and change is anxiety-provoking. So I just thought I'd add that to the conversation, that it's very difficult for people because addictions have two-way swords. On one hand, when you go to improve the health of your diet and cut out the salt and the sugar and the oil and the junk and the processed and the junk food, you feel worse. You don't feel better temporarily. So number one, when you stop smoking or stop using drugs, you temporarily are in pain and discomfort, and that occurs with food too. People getting headaches and shakes and stomach cramping and fatigue and weakness and some anxiety when trying to eat healthier, number one. And the second thing is, of course, is that they're missing that high, and psychologically their brain is looking for excuses and reasons to justify their old behaviors. And then we have society which supports these addictions because everybody's doing them, and it makes it so it's harder. It's easier to quit alcohol or to quit shooting cocaine because at least society recognizes those things are harmful. So this is even more difficult for people to quit.
Fascinating. Please give us the second part, but I want to come back to that because what you're really talking about this. In, we've often said mind, body, and spirit, et cetera, are all connected. But, you're really talking about the biological sort of vicious cycles of low mood leading to an addictive behavior and the addictive component of this. And then it kind of leads to that behavior, and then it reinforces that low mood. Like when you said earlier in the show that, eating baked goods or whatever increases depression. And yet what is the classic thing that, everybody, they'll show it in films or whatever, they write stories about it. If you're having a bad day with your boyfriend, go eat a donut,
Right. Right. Commercial baked goods are associated, even two servings a week of commercial baked goods, like a donut or a cookie, are associated with 50% double. That means a 50% increased risk, almost doubling the risk of developing depression just from two servings of commercial baked goods a week. And listen to this statistic, really fascinating, that children who eat French fries once a week have a 27% increase of breast cancer as an adult. That's an amazing statistic. We're talking here how dangerous it is to eat commercially prepared or fast food prepared deep fried foods, which causes rancidity and carcinogenic free radicals to form. And when people consume those foods, they increase the risk of autoimmune diseases, lupus, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis in later life, multiple sclerosis, but even dementia, but even cancer, years later. So remarkable how dangerous these foods are. And people are just, they bring their kids donuts, fried bread and sugar to their soccer games, and do they think to themselves that they're increasing their child's risk of cancer for doing so, or their risk of developing an autoimmune disease or developing dementia in later life? It's just that people are so, obviously nutrition is such an important subject. It's at the basis of so many of our problems in society, including perpetuating, like you were saying earlier, in the urban inner cities, perpetuating such suffering and bad health, and it perpetuates bigotry and racism. Because now people have poor access to food, and their poor outcomes intellectually, financially, or disease problems are blamed on their genes or their persons, when really it's access to food and that's the problem, and the lack of, and if we had, a political climate, if we had even had a, entertainment and industry, if we had athletes and entertainers and people and public authorities and politicians and educators and teachers and everybody got behind the dangers of this fast food genocide occurring in our society, and we, on one hand, educated our population how dangerous these foods are, on the other hand, enabled access to the right foods, we'd solve so many problems in our society and have such an incredible effect on reducing human tragedies. This is such critical information that you and I are talking about here, but it's largely unknown by conventional people. They ignore these subjects.
By conventional medical doctors. Well, there's a problem because, at this point, I think it's fairly obvious that our democracy, our governmental system, and this is something I, speak about and cover in my reporting, speak about on the show and bring on speakers about this regularly, but we have a kind of captured system where, we have conventional medicine. We have conventional agriculture, pesticide-ridden, laden with chemicals, And, you know, we don't actually, you know, the major investment in the food supply is not toward healthy foods. Then those same parties subsidize politicians who then turn around and subsidize that kind of agriculture, which is laden with all kinds of poisons. So, you know, we just said the pharmaceutical industry, the food industry, the energy industry destabilizes the climate, and it also pollutes, increasing toxicity. So just when we need, you know, creating a situation where we need more of, you know, these nutrients to combat an increase in toxins that we're exposed to, and that's lacking. So, you know, these are all kind of, and then where does the investment go? These are all interactive problems, and if you try to pass legislation to support the organic food supply, you know, you've got a lineup of big industries opposing you and, you know, talking in the ear of the legislators who decide the vote, sending their employees into the regulatory positions in public agencies. Now we have a situation where, due to corporate influence, we have an administration that's tearing down any form of protection of food, health, and environment. They basically, it runs against their donors, their supporters, those industries. And, you know, the big outcome from all of this is there are several major ones. I mean, really, declining health, declining democracy, and declining habitability of the planet itself. So, you know, and then, I mean, here's where also I'm really fascinated by your analysis of addiction. Then you also have a population who are not that well capable of grasping the overall problem or of acting on their own behalf, because they are repeatedly doing what's easiest, what they've grown accustomed to, what they're addicted to, what's easy to get, what they're told is okay, and all of that. So you kind of have a large segment of the population that is not kind of on board or, you know, able to motivate and activate to sort of fight and stand up for health.
Yeah, I agree that our population is dumbed down because the food they're eating affects their intelligence. It's well established that in studies, for example, that children who are fed unhealthy have lower IQs and lower success, and that fast food is linked to lower IQ and also behavioral, cognitive, and psychiatric problems due to eating poor food in early life. So we know that fast food and processed foods lead to behavioral problems and not just disease risks. So we're talking here right now about the effect of fast food, junk food, and processed foods, not just on the body, but also on the brain and your ability to be a good citizen, be economically successful, to recognize the American dream, and to be and have a happy life. So, you know, so this is all interrelated, and I think you're right. We have a population that could oppose some of the negativity if they were exposed to better food. And obviously, we're all working together, and it's a process, and some inroads are being met, but more has to be done, and especially to focus on people who are economically disadvantaged. When we're subsidizing the junk food and making fruits and vegetables more expensive, but you know, my work in particular, I show people how eating healthfully can taste delicious. I show them that it doesn't have to be expensive. I try to produce as much information to remove the obstacle people have, how to get rid of the food addictions, how to, you know, where to start, you know, and motivation, encouragement, camaraderie, and skills to show them they can get a lot of pleasure from eating healthy. And I always talking about putting the oxygen mask on yourself first and then help others. You're talking about how this is affecting society and how we can have a better, you know, protect the earth and help humanity by us all getting healthier. But it has to start with each individual person taking care of their own health and not being, because you can't accomplish anything if you're sickly and you can't think straight, and you're developing dementia and memory loss and cognitive dysfunctions from eating junk food. So the first step has to be that people have to put on the oxygen mask, take good care of their own health, and then they can be the best version of themselves possible to be as productive in their job, to be as economically successful, and to be as influential as possible on other people and on the rest of our society. So, you know, I think we have to marry all this information together.
Go ahead. I was going to ask you about beans, because when you said when you say that your that the food nutrition that you propose can be done inexpensively, I was, you know, you actually documented in your books. I mean, you don't just make that claim and then people go and they have sticker shock, and then, you know, when they try to buy accordingly, you actually compare the price of a meal in the standard American diet approach and a meal in what you're suggesting, and it is actually less expensive. I found that really fascinating, because usually...
And then consider the medical costs and lack of productivity at work and all the other factors influencing your health when you're not eating healthy, besides the cost, too. The costs are tremendously multiplied when you're not eating, your cost of living, when you're not in good health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other piece of it that really interested me is that you, in your recommendations, you tell people eat a big salad every day, eat some steamed vegetables every day. You know, so you're not breaking it out in so much in meal plans, but just saying this is what you should be including in what you're eating every day, which is actually, it's something that's, I really like that recommendation a lot. You know, add more seeds in, add some mushrooms, eat some beans every day. Those are, you know, that's basically my take on your recommendation.
Right. Well, you know, I do make available, like I have a 10 and 20 guide for people to tell them what to eat at each meal. You know, some people need more help and more guidance than others. So some people would prefer just overall viewpoints like that, and other people want to know, well, what do I eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? When I go to what do I shop at the supermarket? Give me 20 days of meal plans and how I should eat every single day to make sure I lose 10 pounds and get started on this for the rest of my life. The point is that the information is available to you. And I have an acronym that I've made called G-BOMBS. That's G plus BOMBS, B-O-M-B-S. And G-BOMBS helps people have at the tip of their tongue those foods that have the highest anti-cancer benefits, that they're supposed to remember these foods to try to eat them regularly. And each one of these foods individually reduce cancer rates by more than 50%, but taken collectively, making a dietary style that includes a portfolio of all these powerful anti-cancer foods is where we can see tremendous benefits to pushing the envelope of human longevity. And the G, let me tell you what it stands for. G-BOMBS stands for greens, and the B for beans, and the O for onions, the M for mushrooms, the second B for berries, and the S at the end for seeds. And so G-BOMBS, greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds. Oops, pardon me on that. And the so we're saying here that looking at seeds, for example, like the lignans in flax seeds or chia seeds, showing that in a 10-year study of women who had breast cancer, the women had a 71% decreased mortality or death rate from breast cancer, the ones who ate seeds versus one who didn't. Likewise, another Asian study showing women who ate 10 grams of mushrooms a day, the size of your thumb, just a little bit of mushroom a day, compared to women who didn't eat mushroom, had a 64% lower risk of developing breast cancer. They mixed green tea or greens with mushrooms each day, and then they had a 89% lower risk of developing breast cancer. The point that I'm making is that modern nutritional science has such incredible data, and I've actually put together a protocol, so an anti-cancer protocol that we're doing a study we have at Northern Arizona University called the Nutritarian Women's Health Study, where we have more than 1,500 women already signed up in the study, that we're recruiting women who are following these dietary portfolios to reduce cancer and tracking their progress over the years. So very exciting, as my work as the president of the Nutritional Research Foundation, setting up studies around the country to help change the face of healthcare. And and I know we were also talking about a little earlier how the medical profession not only doesn't help, but they can actually hurt the process of people making changes, because the pharmaceutical industry, in conjunction with the way medicine is practiced and the money they spend at supporting, you know, with lobbyists supporting this governmental viewpoint where where healthcare is focused on medications and not focused on food, when food is can be 100 times more effective at protecting people's lives. Let me give you an example. You have high blood pressure, you go to a doctor, and he gives you a drug to lower your blood pressure. That doesn't reduce your risk of having a stroke or a heart attack very much, probably less than 10%. Whereas if you didn't have a drug, and he told you to change your diet, and you knocked your blood pressure down by eating healthier, which is more effective. Actually, he's published a study on that showing a nutritarian diet lowered systolic blood pressure by 26 millimeters mercury, which is more powerful than drugs. But had he given you a diet and you changed your diet, you would decrease the risk of heart disease or stroke by more than 100 times over what the drug could have done. And you weren't told that the drug could increase risk of cancer. For example, a recent study showed that women taking calcium channel blockers for 10 years or more had a double the risk of developing breast cancer. And statin drugs increasing risk of invasive breast cancer. They'll give you these drugs that cause cancer that don't protect you, and you think you're protected. So there's no incentive now to change your diet, and the emotional effects are that you think you're okay now that the numbers look better. So the same thing is true with diabetes. More drugs, more doctor visits, more death. You know, that, and we have the means where people can reverse their diabetes and become non-diabetic. And we have the nutritional protocols where people don't have to have heart attacks. And they don't have to have chest pain and atherosclerosis. They don't have to resort to angioplasties and bypass surgery. That the atherosclerotic process is a reversible process, just like you're losing weight. You can open up the blood vessels. You can restore the blood flow to your heart. You can bring your blood pressure and cholesterol back to normal. That medical care is maybe appropriate for emergencies, but for chronic illnesses, it's a failure. It's not effective, and in most cases, it's not helpful. So the fact that our medical profession, you go to doctors and people just get drugs and no discussion and no education and no information on the dangers of that approach and how more effective nutrition can be, is really selling out people, not giving them the option to even make a choice.
Yeah, that's really powerful stuff. As we're talking, you know, because I've been in the health field, I'm aware of all of this and I follow it, except for the fact that I will eat a spelt cookie, a couple times a week, and now I'm kind of rethinking that. But I'm pretty focused on this, and also, you know, I've changed my diet multiple times and eaten in different nutritional styles, so that it's much easier when you have made a change. And I'm not recommending the kind of change where you ping pong your weight, or where you lose a lot of weight and then you gain it back. But when you've had some versatility in your food style, then it's easier next time there's a need to fine tune than if you've kind of been eating what everyone eats all along, and then you're kind of going against the grain to make a change. But as you're speaking, I'm thinking of all the people I know who I won't cite or talk in any detail about, but who have health issues in various of the categories that you're talking about, and just spending time and watching them eat. And you don't want to kind of be a friend that's like lecturing people about their diet when they haven't asked your opinion very much. But I am sometimes amazed by what people eat, with all of the knowledge that is out there and has been out there. And more that's coming to the fore. So, what you're talking about is really, really important. Let's talk just a little bit about the beans, because in my view, they play a kind of interesting role. I ate meat for many years. I still eat meat occasionally. But in recent times, I've really been feeling like I don't want to be eating that much meat. It's really for health reasons. And also, I just kind of don't feel like it. I don't know how else to describe it. If somebody had come from the outside and told me you should be a vegetarian and you should be a vegan, I would have kind of ignored them, because I've also placed a kind of premium on maintaining a healthy weight. And what I saw vegetarianism when I was younger was that people ate a lot of bread, they ate cookies, they were constantly eating things to compensate for the loss of animal protein. And knowing my own system, I knew that I would gain weight doing that, and I didn't want to be kind of starving and then eating sweets or bread or pasta and gaining weight. I didn't think that was the original iteration of the vegetarian diet was unhealthful, and as more information has come about over the years about glycemic responses of the body and eating a low glycemic diet, a diet that doesn't prompt an insulin release and sugar response, it's clear that that kind of eating is not that sustainable. But you really emphasize beans, and I just, I think they can make a really big difference as a transitional substitute, so that, instead of reaching reflexively for the meat product, you can have the hummus, you can have the chili, you can have a bean soup, or you can have nut butter, you can make a sauce from a nut butter, a salad dressing from nut butter, all of that. So I'd love to hear more about the science of the bean and seed nut end of the spectrum here, because I think we've heard a lot about the vegetables, or at least many
and
people
I know
have.
A few of the concepts you had said I don't really agree with, because, you'll probably agree with what I'm saying, but beans shouldn't be seen as a transitional or as a substitute for eating meat. The beans by themselves in their own right are powerful anti-cancer foods and lifespan-promoting foods associated with centenarians, with people who live more than 100 in many different blue zones and cultures. But the point here that we're getting at is that in a nurse's health study, for example, bean eaters, women who eat beans, had the lowest rate of breast cancer of all people tested, that beans are rich in inositol pentacis phosphate, IP5, which is a powerful phytochemical that fights breast cancer. But beans, if we score all carbohydrate sources, squash, oatmeal, whole wheat bread, corn, potatoes, rice, anything you could think of on a hierarchical scale of quality, we find that beans have the most fiber, have the most micronutrient density per calorie. They have the highest amount of slowly digestible starches that are fed into the bloodstream over many hours as opposed to rushing in, so they're the lowest glycemic effect of all carbohydrates. And they have the most resistant starch as well. And resistant starch are the calorie portion that's not absorbable into the bloodstream. They're resistant to enzymatic degradation, which means that the calories listed on a can of beans are not really the calories, because some of those calories are not absorbable and passed through into the toilet bowl because they're resistant starch. And that means even though beans are high in protein, they're about 30% protein, the actual effective protein content in beans, because some of the carbohydrate calories are lost, is even higher than 30%. So beans are high protein, low glycemic, high fiber, and the resistant starch calories, because they're not degraded by enzymes, are fermented by bacteria. They form a fuel for the production of bacteria in the gut, and they produce the healthy bacteria that live there all the time. And when you're eating green vegetables and beans and onions and mushrooms on a regular basis, then you fuel the growth of these healthy bacteria that form a biofilm that adhere to the villi of the wall of the small intestines. What I'm saying right now is that the beneficial effect on the microbiome and the biofilm that's formed is very adherent to the wall of the small intestines, compared to when you're taking probiotic capsules or you're taking a fermented food where the probiotics pass right through you, are not as effective as eating the right foods on a regular basis. And now this protective biofilm slows the absorption of glucose through the intestinal tract wall, which means that when you're eating a mango or a bowl of oatmeal, the glycemic load of that meal will be lower because you're a regular bean eater, because the bean thickened the biofilm, and the biofilm created by the beans reduces the glycemic effect of every food you eat, not just the beans themselves. And that's called, by scientists, it's called the second meal effect, which doesn't just happen at the second meal. It happens at any subsequent meal from regular bean eating. So beans are part of the G-bombs, are a superfood that have anti-cancer effects and longevity-promoting effects. They have anti-diabetic effects. They have weight loss effects. They're high in protein, and they support muscle mass and bone mass with aging as well. Whereas animals, it's not a question of, we know that, I also didn't agree with the idea of, like, the iteration of vegetarian diets. And we have people eating junk foods, whether they're vegetarian or not. And whether you eat meat or not, there's no lower amount of junk food eating or white flour and white sugar and commercial processed foods and baked goods more, there's not a higher instance of those consumers and vegans at any point. It's always been the standard American diet. Meat eaters always ate more of those foods anyway. Vegetarians always did a little better because they generally, even from the very beginning, ate less processed foods, less white flour, high glycemic processed carbohydrates in that community. It's more emphasized today, but nevertheless, one of the advantages of moving towards your diet to more higher in natural plants is the reduction of the animal products and processed foods, which neither one contain phytochemicals or antioxidants or fibers or resistant starch. So let me just say this one more time, that I'm saying that a piece of chicken is like a bagel. And the reason I'm saying a piece of chicken is like a bagel, because neither a bagel nor a piece of chicken is a significant source of micronutrients. They contain macronutrients, they're both calorically dense, but they neither one has antioxidants and phytochemicals that support the immune system to fight cancer. And number two, they both have no fiber. And number three, they both promote hormones that accelerate the rate of cancer. The bagel produces insulin, which raises up in your tissue, and insulin is a fat storage hormone, promotes cellular replication and cancer. So when you eat, you know, croissants and bagels and cookies, you're promoting cancer. It's like you might as well snort cocaine if you can eat white bread. I'm saying the whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead, is one of my common statements, you know. And then likewise, when you're eating this high-protein chicken or egg whites, you're taking in concentrated calories of animal protein, and animal protein consumed like that raises IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, which is not raised by plant protein, by the way, is only raised by concentrations of animal protein, and it's why skim milk causes more acne than whole milk does, and why skim milk is related to prostate cancer more than whole milk does, because we take out the fat, we concentrate the protein even more, and it's the protein component, the concentrated animal protein, that raises IGF-1 to such unfavorable levels. And IGF-1 is the hormone, besides estrogen, of course, that's closely associated with breast cancer and prostate cancer and aging of the brain. So IGF-1 promotes cellular replication and cancer. It's shaped like the insulin molecule. It's why it's called insulin-like growth factor 1, because it binds to the insulin receptor, promoting fat storage and growth of fat of weight on your body and increasing insulin resistance. So this sandwich, this hamburger, you know, processed foods and meat, or of ham and cheese, or pizza, or macaroni and cheese, this combining the glycemic carbohydrates with the animal product, you know, I always joke around and say this diet style couldn't be better designed if it was made by ISIS to kill us. You know, it's like this is the worst, the most dangerous thing we could possibly do is eat this high glycemic, high animal protein sandwich that's the hallmark of the American style of eating. It's the most dangerous way you can eat, and that's really leading to a treacherous amount of human tragedy in this country, because we're so misinformed and addicted to this unhealthy style of eating.
Well, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and that's really fascinating. I just want to kind of back up on what I said, which is, and I'll phrase it a different way, because what I have found in my recent shift over the last, I guess, 6 months in terms of my diet is that eating more beans makes a huge difference, because I would say beans, nuts, and seeds, because it's very satiating, and I don't crave the meat at all. I'm not craving, you know, there's nothing where I feel like my diet was incomplete, I need to eat something else, and then maybe it's the wrong thing. You know, perhaps it's the effect of what you're actually, you know, which, for the scientific reasons that you just mentioned. But I'm personally having that experience and recommend it highly, and it feels great. And in fact, people have said to me who know me, they're like, you like hummus a lot. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I do. And all of, you know, these other bean dishes and everything. But I have to say, I didn't believe myself as a long-term health writer and journalist that I could actually move away to a vegetarian/vegan diet so easily as I found it to be. I thought that from my earlier experience, which I described, I thought everybody was starving, that I was going to be noshing on cookies all the time to make up for stuff, because that was my experience when I was younger. And I have to say, doing it this way is really doable. and you know, my energy has improved. It's really actually great. And I would say I've always eaten a lot of nuts. Actually, I would say that the beans really make a big difference, huge difference.
Terrific, yeah,
and it's
definitely
not like you have
and
to
also,
eat like
also,
tons
that's
of
right. And when you eat nuts and seeds and make salad dressings with nuts and seeds and desserts and ice creams and everything else and creamy, delicious food, it facilitates the absorption of the antioxidants and phytochemicals, which a lot of them need some fat inclusion in the meal for maximizing the absorption. So what I'm saying right now is that when you eat a salad, like with, you know, watercress or arugula on top or kale on top of the salad with shredded onion, when you eat all these high anti-cancer foods or and then you include a dressing that includes some nuts and seeds, you can absorb 10 times the amount of these phytochemicals and antioxidants, increasing your longevity. And we find that in studies on, like, on modern studies on long-lived populations, that the inclusion of nuts and seeds in the diet radically extends lifespan. And we're talking here, when we compare the consumption of sesame seeds to sesame oil, or walnuts to walnut oil, or almonds to almond oil. In other words, it's the whole food mixing into the salad dressing, not the oil from those foods. When you take the fiber out and you move the sterols and stanols and nutrients out of the food and just take the oil consumption of the food, we have a completely different biological effect on the body. They promote fat storage hormones. They're absorbed very rapidly. They promote overeating. They're calorically concentrated. They're lacking the beneficial effects. And when you do eat the whole food, you actually, remember I said a few minutes earlier that all the calories in beans aren't biologically available. They pass through into the toilet bowl. Well, likewise, when we eat the whole walnut, sesame seed, almond, and, you know, when we eat the whole seed or nut, we not only get those beneficial nutrients in the nut or seed, but all the fat calories are not biologically available to the body because the high amount of binding sterols and stanols suck fat out into the toilet bowl, meaning that all their fat calories are not absorbable, so you feel more satiated and you're not getting even all those calories in as you would have gotten had you had the processed food. So I'm also saying not only is cooked oil carcinogenic, mutagenic, and teratogenic, not only does it cause birth defects and cancer when you heat oil, actually oil is so cancer-causing that, and we talked about one serving of French fries increasing risk of breast cancer by 27%, one serving of French fries a week even. But actually, even working in a fast food restaurant, not even eating the food, just breathing in the oil that's coming off the fryers is detrimental to a person's health. Or working in a movie theater, breathing in the gas coming off the popcorn because they've cooked that oil, because it's artificial oils that they're cooking at high temperatures. But in any case, we're talking here about, yes, using more beans instead of more animal products, but also very, very important to get most of your fat intake from natural foods like nuts and seeds, as opposed to the processed version, which is oil, or getting most of your fat from cheeses and animal products and butter. So it's saying most of our fat intake, likewise, this is the secret to extending human life. This is the secret to making, to living to 95 to 105 years old and narrowing that bell-shaped curve so we don't have genetics won't play a role now. We'll all live a long time instead of so many people dying young and having all spreading the age of death across a broad spectrum of human tragedies. We can narrow that curve, have almost all people live a long time when we use these new advances in nutritional science to make a diet that includes these natural foods. And it's these advances in nutritional science and the science that supports them that gives people the motivation and the information to make these changes. And I lecture to urban cities, I lecture to, you know, to young people, and when they get the right information, and they get the information in a very thorough manner, and the amazing protective and dramatic benefits can result in their lives, you'd be amazed at how many people are willing to make these changes, and especially when we can show them we can make this food taste delicious and have great recipes to give them at the same time.
I think that's really fantastic. I mean, that's really great work. But, you know, I have to ask you, what about olive oil? Because the whole Mediterranean diet approach, you know, cook in olive oil, use it in your salads, and what you're saying is kind of opening up a different vista around that. I mean, is it basically like you're recommending that people, like even so-called healthy, organic, or whatever, olive oil is less healthy than was thought when there was this promotion of the Mediterranean diet? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's just more marketing scams, you know, that telling people what they want to hear. In other words, we can make any food look good. We can make eggs look good by comparing them to donuts. And compared to sugar, the eggs look much better. We could have the diet have so much, you know, so much stuff in it that if you take out a little bit of egg, it's not going to make a difference. We can make anything look good. The studies on oil, oil is 120 calories per tablespoon. The average American consumes over 400 calories in oil a day. We have the most overweight population in the history of the human race. The average American woman weighs 168 pounds today. 100 years ago, she weighed 118 pounds. Now she weighs 168 pounds. That's unbelievable. So there, and one of the and you get increased risk of cancer as well as dementia from that extra weight on your body. You can't be overweight and healthy. There's no such thing as an overweight healthy people. Well, people are now saying we should be that oil is now health food. This is crazy. I mean, you could tolerate a little bit of oil if you're slim and very physically active, maybe working in the field as a farmer behind a plow 8 hours a day, burning up a huge amount of calories, but not sitting on your can. And in an office expecting to burn off those amount of extra calories. The other thing is that the Mediterranean diet only showed a small degree of benefit compared to the American diet. They still have a lot of heart disease, strokes, and cancers over in those countries. And, you know, because and eating pizza and white flour and oil is not the benefit of the Mediterranean diet. It's eating the nuts and the red and the tomato sauce, you know. But in any case, we can go on and on. But the PREVAMED study showed that compared to butter or saturated fat, people who ate olive oil more servings per week had a 30% lower risk of heart disease comparing butter or saturated fat to more olive oil. And then when people switched in the PREVAMED study from oil to walnuts, so they studied people eating more nuts in general compared to using more oil, the heart attack rates went down another 40% over what people were eating butter. The point I'm making is that just because oil is better than butter doesn't make it a health food. Just because an egg might be better than a donut doesn't make it a health food either. We have to compare, you know. So in other words, what's the replacement calories? When we replace any kind of oil, when we replace olive oil, which is very weight gain promoting and pro-inflammatory, by the way, and it has 14% saturated fat. That's right. And, and oil also is one of the foods that make us crave more calories. Oil, salt, and sugar make people overeat calories. And if we're looking for an anorexic, having them to gain more weight because they're not eating, putting oil in their food might be helpful. But if you're a person that's over your ideal weight, then putting oil in your food is counterproductive because it's a formula for weight gain and disconnectivity between your satiation neural hormones. In other words, let me say this one more in a simpler way. That the body is based to sense fiber and volume in response with calories. And when we take in oil with no fiber and volume, it comes through as free calories. Our brain doesn't register it. I can add 200 calories to your lunch, and you'll still consume through oil, and you won't register those calories. If I ate the 200 calories through walnuts or through sesame seeds, you'd stop eating 200 calories before. You'd cut 200 calories out of that meal because you'd feel like you had enough food before you reached the limit of your feeling that you had enough. When you put the oil in, it's completely hidden. Oil induces overeating. It's fattening. And, of course, Americans are tremendously overeating in it. And where's the excess calories? If this is true, that nuts and seeds have so many powerful longevity-promoting effects and anti-cancer effects and anti-arrhythmia effects. And nuts and seeds in the Nurses and Physicians Health Study linked to 60% low risk of sudden cardiac death and cardiac arrhythmias and prolonged lifespan. If nuts and seeds prolong lifespan, how do you have enough caloric pie, room in your calorie pie, to add 400 calories of oil to your food and put nuts and seeds on too and not become overweight? You can't. There's no room in the diet to eat oil plus nuts. You know, so is it walnut oil or is it walnuts? Is it coconut oil or is it coconut? Is it sesame seeds or is it sesame oil? And when you make the comparison, there's no comparison. One is high calorie, one's low calorie. One's high anti-cancer, one's pro-cancer. One's pro-anti-inflammatory, one's pro-inflammatory. One reverses heart disease, one promotes heart disease. And any time you're eating a food that's promote weight on your body and promote weight gain, it can't be good for your health. We're looking to remove empty calories out of our diet and substitute foods that contain nutrients. Now, one of the basic principles of a nutritarian diet to promote longevity is to eat foods that have a higher nutrient, micronutrient content. You want to eat a diet with a high micronutrient per calorie density, which is the formula that determines your longevity and your healthy life expectancy. Oil is the perfect, you could say, is the opposite of that. It's a food with a high caloric density with no significant nutrient load. It's just calories. Caloric concentrated calories in your body, which might be helpful if you're starving or you're suffering, like if you're naked and alone on an island and you can't find any food to eat. Yeah, getting some calories in can be helpful. But we have the opposite. We have an island here with excess calories, and we're looking to take calories out of the diet, not concentrate and put more calories into the diet. So I think that it's a general myth that's promoted by people all over the place because they're just like on the oil bandwagon telling people what they want to hear. It's dishonesty because you tell people what you want to hear and they like it. You know, it's like I've never really, focused my work to try to tell people what they want to hear to sell more books with a trick or a fad or a gimmick. I just wanted to tell people what's ideal, and if they don't want to do it, let them not do it. But at least they should not be tricked into thinking that something is good when it's not. You know what I mean? And they should know the relative value of each choice they're making to know what relatively what would be the best thing they could have done. And then you don't sell out the people who are thinking they're doing the right thing and they're not getting results. Look at all I work at a local hospital here, and they were running this Mediterranean diet program where nobody was losing any weight or getting any benefits from it. So they switched over to my program, and now the people are becoming non-diabetic, and they're getting rid of their high blood pressure medication. They're all dropping 20 pounds, in the first 6 weeks. But the point I'm making right now is that if a person really has a serious problem, and they're looking to get well and reverse their diabetes and get lower their blood pressure or to reverse their early-stage cancer, and you don't give them the best information available, and you try to water down the information to make it more palatable or more popular, then you've sold out those individuals because you sold out their chance to get well. You sold out their ability to reverse that cancer. You sold out their ability to totally get well that they would have achieved if you had explained this program and designed it to be ideal and not watered it down to have more people like it better. And so if you want to water it down or a person wants to, they can do that. But I want to not water down the message because I want to not sell out those people who need to do or want to do what's best.
Thank you. This is really great. I learned a lot actually on this show, and I'm really, really grateful that you have come on and joined us here in Connect the Dots today. We're coming to the end of our hour here. We've been talking with Dr. Joel Fuhrman, the author of The End of Dieting and The End of Heart Disease, as well as Eat to Live. And these are terrific recommendations. I'm so grateful. Listeners, if you feel, and I'm sure this is true for many of you, that your diet could use some real fine-tuning and sharpening for the sake of health, please check out Dr. Joel Fuhrman's books. Fuhrman is spelled Fuhrman. You can also go to his website. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really, really appreciate it. And I love both, your passion and your commitment to people, as well as the science and wisdom that you share with us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Allison. Anytime. And good luck and best of health to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well, chin up, and keep marching forward.
Well,